This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
This year, in order to make room for the extra demographic pressure, we're going to have to find something in the region of £80 million worth of savings. And that is, these are huge numbers, the like of which we've never been able to achieve before. And we're running very, very close to the edge of bankruptcy.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to this edition of the Kent Politics Podcast. My name is Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council. And I'm joined by Robert Boddy, who looks after Medway Council.
Hello.
And Daniel Esson, who looks after the district councils and the borough councils.
Hello.
Later, we'll be joined by our special guest, Richard Streatfield, a long-time Kent councillor and former Lib Dem parliamentary candidate for Sevenoaks. First up, Robert, what's happening in Medway?
So this week I wrote about a young boy with special needs, meaning that he's reliant on a wheelchair and a walker. Thomas, who's 11, has outgrown his current walker, which he's had for a number of years, so was recommended to get a new one by his physio. However, Medway Council turned down the request for the new £4,000 walker.
Okay, what was the thinking behind that then?
Well, Thomas's mum, Emma, says that the council said it would fund the walker if it went to and from school every single day, which is where he uses it a lot of the time. But Emma said this wasn't as straightforward, as both she and her husband, Matt, work full-time and also have to take Thomas's younger sister to school as well. Because of this, they're reliant on the school bus, which takes Thomas every day. However, the bus can't currently accommodate the new walker. Now, Emma asked if it was possible if they could drop the walker off at school on Mondays and pick it up on Fridays until the bus could accommodate the new walker, but Medway Council said no. Emma then asked if they could have the new walker but keep it at home until the bus could accommodate it, and then it would go to school every single day. But she says the council still refused, saying they didn't believe that's what the family would actually do and that they would just leave it at school during the week.
So what does Medway Council say about all this?
Well, they acknowledged that the travel arrangements for the walker had yet to be agreed and so the walker couldn't be funded. But after several attempts to ask if they'd said they didn't believe Thomas's family would keep the walker at home, they didn't answer that question. The council's deputy leader, Theresa Murray, is due to meet with the family to talk about the situation and any possible route forward. However, the good news is that Thomas will get his walker, as his mum posted on the local Raynham Facebook group saying she would do a fun run to raise funds for the walker. But other members asked for a fundraiser to be started, and within 24 hours donated the full £4,000 for the walker. But Emma is clear she's had to do this because the authority has let her down.
What have you been looking at then, Dan?
So recently I had the joy of my first ever two-evening planning committee. It was at Thayer District Council. They were set to decide on a big development of 1,600 homes in Birchington, so they set aside a whole two evenings for it. And despite spending about 6 hours speaking about it total, they somehow still managed to kick the can down the road.
Yeah, 1,600 homes is a sizeable development. Where was this development coming from? What was the response been like?
So the site of this development, just off the edge of Birchington in Thanet, it was allocated for homes in the last local plan, and the development itself has been in the work for something like 4 or 5 years. So homes are going on that site one way or another. I mean, it hasn't really come as a surprise to anyone, but as you might expect, it's been pretty controversial. Over 1,800 people wrote into the council to oppose the application, and there was a protest outside the council chamber on both nights of the meeting.
And what kind of points were the councillors making about it?
So there's a lot of the standard stuff, you know, it'll jeopardise the village's identity, the infrastructure already can't cope, and that kind of thing you hear at every planning meeting. But by far the biggest recurring point was the lack of affordable housing proposed. Thanet Council's policy is that large developments should deliver 30% affordable housing at the very least, but this project was only offering half of that, 15%. There's a possibility it could go up a little bit if the county council get the funding they want for a large road, which is going to be part of this development. Then it'll take some pressure off the developers and they'll be able to provide 23% affordable housing, but that will still only be 368 homes on 800 on a 1,600 home development.
It doesn't make it easier to throw out?
You would think so, but so because of planning rules, it's important to bear in mind that there's lots of legislation and local government finance rules, largely initiated under Margaret Thatcher and, you know, in every government since, that are pretty explicitly designed to make it impossible for local councils to actually build their own homes anymore. When people talk about council housing, councils don't build homes and they don't usually own or manage their own homes anyway. It's housing associations. As such, pretty much all development is done by private firms, and national planning policy works on this basis. Specifically, profit and business viability for developers is baked into the planning system. The government says that 15 to 20% profit on a development is, you know, viable and acceptable, and that's what councils should aim for. So if the developers in this case say if they gave 30% affordable homes like Thanet Council would want from them in theory, profit would only be 2.35%, still pretty tidy 15 million quid or so, but not very much in the grand scheme of development. So to make the development viable with a much healthier profit of 93 million, they say they had no choice but to offer less affordable housing.
So what did the committee decide?
So council officers were recommending that councillors vote to approve the plans, but largely because of the lack of affordable housing, they instead voted to defer it to request that they look at other ways to see if they can get more affordable housing on the site. But like I said, because of how planning policy works, it seems pretty clear that if they were going to get any more than is on offer, they would already know by now.
So what's happening at County Hall this week, Simon?
Well, every time we talk about roads, it seems to be bad news. But on this occasion, it sort of seems to be good news, or so it seems on the face of it. As a result of some of the work being done by County and Borough councillors, a very busy road just outside Maidstone looks like it could be widened.
Which road is this and where?
Well, it's the busy section of the A228 at Merriworth, which carries a massive volume of traffic every day. And local people are concerned that it's becoming increasingly dangerous, especially at the Kent Street junction. It's a sort of little crossroads where local people are finding it really hard to join the main highway because of the amount of traffic that speeds past day and night.
And what have councillors achieved here?
Well, Sarah Hudson and Matt Borton. Sarah Hudson is a Kent County Councillor and a District Councillor. Matt Borton is the leader of the Thomas and Morling Borough Council. Have persuaded Kent County Council's highways people to have a look at the traffic situation again, and they've sought funding and got funding from Section 106 money, developer contributions. A couple of the plans he developed, a plan to widen two corners at the Kent Street junction and install some traffic lights. There's also an idea to put a couple of bus stops in, which acts as a natural sort of way of slowing down traffic.
And when is this likely to happen?
Well, the KCC Cabinet Highways member, Neil Baker, said that the provisional date he has in mind is next spring. This has been in the culmination of years of lobbying by the councillors Hudson and Borton, and Councillor Baker has said discussions with the landowner are ongoing, but acknowledged that the work will be done to make it happen. But critics might allege the timing of the announcement about the start of work might have something to do with the KCC elections next year, but that's what a cynic might say.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Richard Streetfield is a Kent County Councillor and District Councillor for Sevenoaks, and like many before him, served in the Army before entering politics, not least the new MP down the road in Tunbridge Wells. He is with us now. Welcome, Richard. How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. Yeah, all good.
Thanks for joining us. You've had a pretty varied career before you emerged into Kent politics. Tell us a little bit about where you come from.
Yeah, I'm Kent born and bred. So I grew up in a small village in the south of Sevenoaks district at the time in Chiddingstone, where my family had been for some time. And I went to school in Tunbridge at the Judd School, and then went off to university and then to the army, where my service took me to Bosnia and Kosovo initially around the time of the millennium, and then to Northern Ireland for a bit, and then latterly 2009-10 in Afghanistan, and I left the army in 2012 and came back to live in Chiddingstone. And then I kind of got slowly into politics. I started off as just trying to do my bit for the parish council, and then realised that what I wanted for the village couldn't be done just through the parish council. That it had to be kind of, and went from there to the district, and then to the county, and that's been a journey kind of through the levels. And so I really wanted to get into county council politics, mainly because of the issues with special educational needs. But I got put on the adult social care committee when I first got elected in 2021. And it is the thing that is driving the finances, driving all the financial difficulties of the county at the moment, and is an incredibly serious and complex issue to try and grapple with in 2024.
Yeah, we'll come back to that in a second, if we might. You know, you talked about your journey into politics, and you obviously was a sense of community was very much sort of driving it. But you know, we would sort of you run a business, you're ex-army. It's very much more sort of like almost like the archetypical conservative candidate in politics.
Yeah, in many respects, that's true. I can't deny it. But when I was growing up, my grandmother, what really drove me into being a Liberal Democrat was my grandmother left the Conservative Party after Enoch Powell's speech in 1964, 66, something like that. And the Rivers of Blood speech had a kind of seminal effect on her. She was running camps for the Windrush generation in Chiddingstone over the summer period. And she had a really strong sense of community. She was a scout leader, a guide leader, a church warden, you name it. She was on it, chair of governors of the local school. And yeah, when I was growing up, she just said, you can't be a conservative. If there are people like that, you've got to be really careful about who you want to kind of be. And that was a really seminal moment. So I joined the Liberals in 1989 when I started doing politics at A-level.
So you went on to university after that, and sort of why did you decide to join the army?
Well, at the time, I'd never been interested in the CCF at school, or then Judd had a CCF, and I'd never joined. And then I was a generation that often did a gap year, and I did a gap year, and I went to Outer Mongolia with Operation Rally, as it was at the time, when it then became Rally International. And I met a guy who was in the army, and he joined the kind of the bottom end and went into special forces. And he had a really profound effect on me. He made me the leader of the group. And I was only 19 at the time. And for 3 weeks, he taught me about leadership. And it was an amazing experience. And when I got to university, I went and joined the OTC. And again, I kept running into people who were really great guides or mentors in the army. I remember a guy called Jim Gregg, who was a sergeant major in Birmingham OTC. And yeah, I just got the bug, and I didn't love it for the kind of militaristic side. I loved it for the leadership, for the camaraderie. And at the time, the Labour Party were really in favour of developing a force for good. And that is something that always stuck with me. The army can be a really powerful force for good. And I think it has been in lots of ways. That we all know there have been some difficulties along the way as well. But certainly in Bosnia and Kosovo, I felt I was doing a really important job keeping people who had serious conflict and helping the country stabilize, reconstruct, protect people, and de-escalate the situation. So that felt very kind of strongly that it was as much about public service as about the kind of militaristic aspect.
Very, really interesting that. The general election was a real reversal of fortunes for the Lib Dems, you know, having been in the doldrums since the end of the coalition. What does the party have to do you think, with 70-odd seats now to maintain that momentum into the next election?
Yeah, I mean, a really successful period. Focus on the seats that we could win. Didn't overextend ourselves into areas and spread our resources too thinly, and got the results that we deserved as a result of that strategy. It's now a question, and the party, the new party in Parliament, is still very much finding its feet, finding where it's who's got the expertise to really have an impact in key areas. I think you'll see some really good work being done in committee with scrutiny of legislation, because I know from people like Mike Martin in Tunbridge Wells, who's got an incredible level of expertise on operations. He's got a doctorate in war studies. And there's just about to be a defence and security review, and he will make a huge contribution to the scrutiny of that, and a huge contribution in making sure that we are fit for the future, because that's the real danger, is that after 10 years of stagnation, of difficulty, and of underfunding, that we need to prepare for what is a very difficult and dangerous time ahead.
You stood against Laura Trott in Sevenoaks, and you came reasonably close, possibly with a large chunk of help from Reform, in a seat that was once, you know, considered pretty unassailable. I mean, what was your focus there? What was the strategy of trying to unseat Laura Trott?
I spoke to 2,000 people in the last 2 months from the time the election was called, and I really, because I was born in the constituency, I've come back here, and I already represent parts of it as a county councillor. I recognise that some of the challenges ahead for Sevenoaks can only be achieved from Westminster, and I wanted a really strong local champion to speak up for Sevenoaks and Swanley. Now I have respect for Laura. She's a career politician. She's risen far and fast in the Conservative Party, going from a newly elected MP to being Chief Secretary to the Treasury in a very short space of time. But that by having that career approach, I've felt, and I think others agreed, that she wasn't speaking up for Sevenoaks at the same time. There are things that were being done, but there's a lot, so much to do, that having somebody that I felt was going to be a Sevenoaks MP first and foremost, and not a kind of a Conservative voice from Westminster in the constituency, was a better way around of doing it. So that was the strategy, to just be the local champion, be the person who knows the people in the constituency, and really work hard to represent that voice.
Richard, the historically Labour Party has had, as far as I can tell, almost no presence in Sevenoaks. There's no Labour members on the district council, and I don't know of any on the sort of parishes or town councils around there, as far as I know. Why do you think that's the case? I mean, disparagingly, some people might say Sevenoaks is just too posh for it.
Well, funnily enough, Labour used to do really well in Swanley. That was reflected in the large polling, that Labour consistently was expected to do reasonably well, kind of neck and neck with us, and eventually they only got half the numbers of votes that we did, because people in Swanley have totally rejected the Labour mayor and ULEZ as a very powerful motivator not to vote Labour, because Labour, as far as most working class people in the district, and there are lots of them, have not been on the side of the working man. I heard that all the time in man and woman. I heard that all the time in Swanley. The Labour policy has cost the average family in Swanley who drive across the ULEZ boundary, even though it's just at the end of the town boundary, about £5,000 a family. And it's a huge cost and an unfair cost. And Liberal Democrats in London took Sadiq Khan to court in order to try and get a fairer deal for those people who live just over the boundary. But it does have a very big impact on Labour's popularity in Sevenoaks, in the constituency overall.
The Kent County Council elections come along next May. Few people think that any of the current opposition parties have a chance of winning outright. But how do you see it panning out for the Lib Dems? Can they become the biggest opposition party in perhaps a new coalition type of administration?
Well, we hope to do really well off the back of the kind of showing we had in the general election across the county, particularly obviously in Tunbridge Wells and in Sevenoaks, and we think and hope we can at least double our representation and hopefully more if we can get our strategy right. And we're going to be fighting for every single vote, because you can see that every vote is going to matter in what happens next. And we'll have to deal with what happens next when it happens, when we see how the people of Kent have felt about the current situation in the county, what they think of the Conservative administration, and who they then choose to take their views forward. And I can see a huge range. I felt it in the election. Reform will be standing candidates, I'm sure, and the Conservatives will have to answer for a record that is bringing the county council to the edge of bankruptcy. It'll be an interesting election to see who people choose.
How much of an effect do you think that the Reform vote could have on Labour?
It's really interesting about who Reform picks up from. I was amazed in Swanley, which is the bit of the constituency I know best, where lots of people had voted Conservative last time around, and the choice was Lib Dem or Reform. Now, you'd have thought that those two things were miles apart. But I kid you not, I had a group with me when I took a phone call from someone who was making exactly that choice, and they were as astonished. And these were kind of students of politics in came from Sevenoaks. One had just finished his degree at Warwick, where I was, and he just couldn't believe that people had this view that the. In their own minds, that this was a kind of a choice that they could make, and I think it surprises a lot of people. But it shouldn't be surprising, because Liberal Democrats have traditionally championed local people, and Reform are setting out to do that as well. And so it's not surprising when it's who's going to be your best local champion, who fits in with your values the most closely, and who do you want to represent you at whichever level. In this case, the county council.
Yeah. I mean, do you see or envisage any deals being done with the other sort of, you know, left of centre parties like Greens or Labour Party?
Because no, that's not in our thinking at all. I mean, we will be making every effort to get as many votes as we can, and that there will be places, I'm certain, where our resources don't allow us to compete as hard as we would like to. But there will also be places where we are in a five-way competition, because there will be independents, there will be Reform, there will be Greens, there will be Labour, all competing for people's trust. And we hope as Liberal Democrats that we have proved ourselves to be both local champions and then effective even from opposition. I think one of the things I'm most proud about is I've got things done even from being in a kind of minority.
Mm. If you do end up being part of some sort of a Labour administration, whether you're the biggest party or not, you would inherit, at Kent County Council at least anyway, a complete nightmare. I mean, how do you think that you as a party would go about trying to fix what is going on at KCC, which, you know, for those who are perhaps not aware, you know, is having to find, you know, tens and tens and tens of millions of pounds worth of cutbacks in order to balance the books. And if they don't, they're going to go bankrupt. If they go bankrupt, the government will send the inspectors in and somebody else will run it for them.
Yes. So that is the great danger, is that that happens. But this is not just a Kent problem. It's a countrywide problem in local government, is that, and we've known it's coming since 2012, 2013, where we knew that the population that born just after the Second World War was getting older, was going to use more services, and that at some point, if the funding levels didn't increase alongside that population growth, the population would outstrip the funding. And that is what is happening right now. It was identified in 2013 that it would. They thought it would cross over in 2022. There was a bit of a funding boost a couple of years ago to keep the county's head above water, but we still have more older people using many more services. Quite naturally, they're a much bigger population in the county, and we need a funding settlement that allows from central government the county to do its work.
Yeah, I think we all know that, and you've set out the history lesson. But what we're trying to get to the bottom of here is how the Lib Dems will fix it. I mean, you're the guy who's going to be in charge. Let's say that you are in charge.
Yeah, so we've got to do two or three things. First of all, we've got to make the case for reform, as in not the party, but a change to the way we govern and devolve services out to the lowest level, so that we can make them as efficient as possible. We've got to make, so for example, if people are in charge of their own budgets for health and care, they tend to use them much, much more efficiently than if the county is providing services. So example from Birmingham, where Kent currently has about 15 to 20% of people on personal care budgets. Birmingham now has about 40 to 50% of people on, and are able to use that money much more efficiently and much more to the way those individuals want their care to be provided. So there are some significant elements of reform that can be made. There are absolutely...
Yeah, but Birmingham went busted, didn't it?
It did. But that was to do with an equal pay situation that they hadn't accounted for. I'm just saying the kinds of things that Liberal Democrats would do in order to make sure that the money the county has is being used as efficiently as possible. Because there are certainly ways that we can transform adult social care, that we can deal with special educational needs, which are the big spenders in the county. But no one can get away from the fact that it's about the central government funding, because council tax rises are capped. So we don't have the kind of levels of tax raising powers that would enable us to match the need from local taxation. So, for example, last year, the council tax rose by 5%, but inflation was 11%. So if you don't get a funding formula that matches inflation in some way, then you're going to reduce the numbers of services and you're going to come under a lot of financial pressure. And we are running out of headroom in the budget. There's only about £80 million worth of a budget of £1.6 billion worth that's discretionary spend. And this year, in order to make room for the extra demographic pressure, we're going to have to find something in the region of £80 million worth of savings. And these are huge numbers, the like of which we've never been able to achieve before. And we're running very, very close to the edge of bankruptcy.
Why is it that central government doesn't appear to be listening to the pleas of local government about funding, not just here in Kent, but you know, all over the country? I mean, it's happening everywhere. You named one particular council that's gone bust for a completely different reason, but there are councils crying out for help in order to provide the basic services that they need to provide, you know, much less the discretionary spend that are nice to do.
Yeah, the Conservatives got themselves in a real paradoxical situation where they were going to fund adult social care, which is the big cost in local government, by the tax rise. And then they're about faced with Jeremy Hunt saying, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to reduce that tax and we're not going to give local government the funding that they need to survive. So Boris Johnson came in on a promise to fix adult social care, and then there was a singular failure to make good on that promise. So we are in this mess because of, I have to say, I mean, and it's absolutely clear, I don't think there's any debate that the tax rises and then the tax cut have caused a huge problem for us.
Yeah. If devolution of some sort is the answer, why is no one talking about it or doing anything to make it happen?
Well, they are. The county took a paper that started this process. The Conservative government, the last Conservative government, did recognise that this was going, the reform of local government, especially trying to make it more efficient in terms of having unitary authorities rather than multi-tiered authorities or metro mayors, or kind of there are various ways that you can do it, was going to be. And Kent has set off on the first consultation of how that might work. But it's not going far enough. It's not going fast enough. And the last Conservative government was so wedded to the idea of metro mayors that it couldn't see that probably wasn't going to be the ideal solution for Kent. We need a better solution than a metro mayor for the kind of democracy that we want to have in Kent.
Very finally and very quickly, do you think you'll take Laura Chaws on again at the next general election?
Wait and see. I've got to get selected, because being a good Democratic Party, I am no longer the candidate, and I will have to put my name forward if that is where I'm at in 4 years' time. I'm really looking forward to the next county council elections, and I think there's still lots of work to do at the county level. And yeah, if that ends up being another run at Parliament, then so be it. But it's way too early to be absolutely sure about that yet.
Okay. Richard Streatfeild, Liberal Democrat for Sevenoaks, thank you very much indeed for your time today.
Thank you.
In the past few days, we've seen 1,700 prisoners released early from jail in order to create the capacity. The question is, I guess, well, will it work? What do you think then, Robert?
Well, I think it's the government's really stuck in a hard place here, because the prisoner state capacity is basically, well, there is no capacity. They're really struggling to find places to put people. And then after we had the riots and that whole situation, there's a definite want to put people in prison, but, you know, where do you put them, basically? So the government has basically got to get these people out of prison. But as I think we've discussed elsewhere, where do these people go? And it's only a matter of time, really, before one of these offenders who's been let out is, you know, reoffends does some awful crime, and it's just another headache for the government.
Well, the trouble is that a lot of these guys, if they reoffend, even if they only shoplift, I mean, they're breaking their conditions of parole or whatever they're being given, and they'd be straight back in any case, which case, now, this is part of the problem that a lot of people are a bit worried that their conditions by which they're being released have been somewhat rushed, and therefore the things that need to be set up for them, benefits, etc., housing or whatever, family arrangements, are simply not there, and then they're going to be driven into crime, and they're just going to cause even more of a headache for a criminal justice system which is rather stretched.
Yeah, I mean, Britain has quite a high reoffending rate, especially compared to other countries in Northern Europe, so I think you're right that it's probably a matter of weeks before somebody released in this whole affair commits some heinous crime, and it becomes a massive media storm for the government. But in broader terms, yeah, asking will it work, it depends what you mean by work. I guess in the short term it will double the current capacity of the British prison system, but that's, you know, just saying how crowded they are, not necessarily saying anything about how good the policy is. And it's not going to change the fact that unless you basically stop sending people to prison, yeah, there aren't enough spaces for them. So the government, if they really want to solve this in the long term, I think it was our own Police and Crime Commissioner, Matthew Scott, who said a little while ago, you need to build more prisons and fill them. And does the government have the will to bulldoze through planning policy and that kind of thing to get more prisons built? I don't know, because like expanding prisons takes forever, even just the paperwork. They put in plans to expand some of Kent's prisons about 5 years ago, and some of the applications have only basically just come to light. So the government will have to act pretty fast to build more prisons if they actually want to solve this in the long term.
But we've also talked about on this podcast as well about the issue that there's these massive court backlogs as well. So on top of, you know, we haven't got enough spaces for the current prisoners we've got at the moment. We're trying to build more, but, you know, these people we are letting out may reoffend and need to go back in. On top of that, we've got a whole bunch of people who possibly could be or need to be in prison, and we need space for them as well. I mean, it just seems to be a problem within a problem within a problem.
It seems to be a problem that's just being contained for the minute, and just no thought being given to sort of what's going to happen sort of in 2 days' time, really. Yes, that's an interesting one. This week, there was a bit of a rebellion by some of the Labour MPs over the scrapping of the winter fuel allowance. Is that just a shrewd move to get it out of the way nice and early, or is it politically going to haunt Sir Keir Starmer?
It depends what you mean by haunt. I mean, if in a few months' time TV news stations can find real tragedy stories of, you know, pensioners freezing in their flats because they were deprived of their winter fuel allowance, then maybe it will become a headache for them. I think the political reasoning behind it probably is, well, we may as well front load all of the really unpopular decisions we have to make to try and get them out of the way soon, hoping that by the next election nobody remembers them. But whether it'll actually achieve what the government says economically they set out to do, which is save money, remains to be seen. It depends whether you believe Rachel Reeves's sort of treasury orthodoxy that basically all we need to do is just constantly spend less money, because that's the same thing she was saying in the election campaign and also 10 years before that when she worked for Ed Miliband.
I think there's definitely front loading this parliament, you know, keeping difficult decisions, that's their phrase that they use all the time, but keeping these decisions as close to the last election as possible, so that, you know, next time around everyone's forgotten them by then. But I think also there is the case of, we're in this period, I mean, a lot of people talk about the honeymoon for Labour, but there's also the afterglow of the Conservative government. Basically, how long can Labour say, well, if the Conservatives had been a bit better in the previous government, things wouldn't be so bad? And so attaching this winter fuel allowance cut to the so-called £22 billion black hole which Labour says the Conservatives left them, they're really trying to take onto that. I think it's also the fact that this is going on while we've got the Conservative Party leadership contest, because Kemi Badenoch, amongst others, previously said that the winter fuel allowance should be means tested as well. So kind of while there's discussion about what the different candidates for the leader of the opposition, what their policy position would be on this, it kind of takes a little bit, I'm not saying it's an effective way, but it takes a little bit of the sting out of it for what Labour are doing.
You mentioned Kemi Badenoch. Tom Tugendhat, he got through to the final four judges' houses. Yeah, so he goes to conference to give his pitch, and then before the membership get a chance to vote on it, then the final two. So he's got the big time ahead of him, is to try and persuade the people at conference or make a pitch to the wider membership, so that some of the MPs seeing the reaction in the hall might turn around and sort of say, Tom's our guy after all.
Yeah, I think this will definitely be, for all of the four candidates, definitely a period of pressing the flesh and, you know, getting their message out there, and I think raising their profile. I think it was quite interesting in this latest round how, although Tom Tugendhat was third, joint with James Cleverly on, I think, 21 votes?
21, yeah.
His vote share had actually risen. I think it think by 4. I think that's correct. Mm. Whereas James Cleverly had stayed the same. So I think, you know, he definitely has a fair shout at saying I'm the sort of the centrist candidate, which him and James Cleverly are vying for. But I think, you know, when it actually comes down to a member's vote, it doesn't really matter whether it's James Cleverly or Tom Tugendhat. They're going to go for a more right-wing candidate.
Yeah, more right-wing. So, but just in the short term, we've got to wonder where Mel Strite's 16 votes might go. I mean, that might push, as you said, push Tom Tugendhat a little bit further ahead of James Cleverly, so he might then occupy that sort of centrist role, and then it'll be obviously Jenrick or Badenoch that'll come through to take the right winger slot. But as Craig McKinley said the other week, he'll always choose the right winger. Okay, folks, that's your lot this week. Thanks to Rob and Dan and our special guest, Richard Streatfield. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics news from across the county. All the best.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.